I guess we should start with a roll call so that we're not just reliant on our observation of people's presence.
Okay. So, Treasurer Reed.
I'm here.
Senator Johnson.
Here.
Representative Nathanson. Representative Nathanson.
I'm here.
Oh, thank you. Katie Koba.
Here.
And Professor Dewey.
Here.
Great. Thank you. Thanks all for making time for us. Obviously, we've got a lot of good information. And Jacqueline, I think I will turn it over to you. I know you have a good roster with you. So we're going to hear a number of different voices today, which I think is a very good thing.
Absolutely. Thank you, Treasurer Reed. And thank you for members of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission for giving me this opportunity to present before you. I am Jacqueline Knights. I am the Director of Debt Management Division of the Office of State Treasury. I am pleased to present, along with some of my colleagues today, the 2021 State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report and our findings with this presentation. We have prepared a larger report, and the presentation will summarize our key elements of that report. And we will also highlight in this presentation areas of the report that have changed. As part of this presentation, we will ask for a vote at the end for you to approve the full report with the understanding that changes made or advised based upon this meeting will be incorporated. With me from my team are Lee Helgerson, our Senior Debt Manager, Matthew Harris, Debt Manager, and Laura Worth, Senior Debt Analyst, and they will all participate in the presentation. So with that said, we will go to the contents of this presentation.
Jacqueline, as you get started, there's one thing I forgot to mention, which is just an acknowledgement of the fact that we're sort of later in the day, and we do have a lot of good stuff to get through. So I'm going to ask people to, unless it's a sort of clarifying question or a quick urgent sort of thing, that will hold the potential of the kind of deeper philosophical conversations we often get to toward the end. So appreciate your understanding of that.
The contents of this, thank you, Treasurer Reed. The contents of this presentation will include a review of the Office of Economic Analysis December 2020 economic and revenue forecast, the current state of Oregon's debt profile, rating agency framework that we use in evaluating debt capacity and how we make recommendations, general fund debt supported capacity as provided in our models, lottery of revenue debt capacity also as provided in our models. And we will highlight certain emerging debt policy issues that have come to light and conclude the presentation. This page is very full, and I want to highlight just certain key aspects of it. We have on a chart on the right that shows something that Oregon has not seen previously. We are seeing volatility. On this particular screen, we have several forecasts of general fund revenues. Commencing with the 2018 forecast, the December 2018 forecast, which is highlighted by the orange line. And that's a very nice line. It's actually our highest line on this page. And then we had the December 2019 forecast, which is the gray line, which is slightly below that. And then we have the December 2020 forecast, which converges with the September 2020 forecast, and that has the jagged line. You see that very big spike. What is happening there, this is all in response to COVID-19, a pandemic. We have not seen this before, and it has its effect is different based on the revenue streams we're seeing in the state. So volatility is a new item for the state of Oregon in terms of revenue forecasts. The general fund revenues as of June 30th, 2020 was $8.3 billion, and we expect to see $12.87 billion in FY 2021 for an aggregate of $21.17 billion. While we have seen this volatility over the past several forecasts, in fact, if you look at the forecast, the aggregate number for the biennium commencing at the beginning of the 2019-21 biennium, you'll see that we're just modestly lower in aggregate. That's very important. Some of the key drivers of why general fund in the aggregate has not been as affected in this current biennium are due in part to the income effect of the CARES Act and the federal dollars that came out of that, on enhanced unemployment benefits, and business payroll protection. In addition, we've had higher than expected corporate income tax receipts and certain modest increases in personal income receipts or stable levels. As we can see by that line, the 2020, December 2020 and September 2020 line, although we have the spike in FY 2021, we see that for the outer years, we are more conservative and the revenue projections are lower, but ramp up to the 2019 projection levels. Next slide, please. Lottery revenues tell a slightly different story. We have on this chart to the right, same volatility, but rather than spike up, it's a precipitous decline. In our initial forecast in June of 2020, exhibited by the gray line, we anticipated a fairly steep decline in lottery revenues. The September forecast, as exhibited by the yellow line, shows an improvement in that, and the December forecast is pretty much the same as the September 2020 forecast. If you look also at the forecast levels for September and December, you will see that they really are still well over the forecast period below the 2019 levels where we commenced the biennium. The issues faced by lottery are different than those faced by the general fund. For the fiscal year 2020, lottery revenues were roughly $699 million. And for the fiscal year 2021, we expect $581.9 million, significantly lower, and in the aggregate, $1.28 billion. This is effectively 10.4% below the $1.43 billion projected in the 2019 setback report. That was the earlier part of the biennium cycle. Since the December 2020 forecast, and this is an area of concern, lottery revenues continue to decline below the levels discussed just now. Based on Executive Order 2065, the temporary freeze, which came into effect November 18th through December 2nd, and the continuing closures of restaurants, bars, and gathering facilities in counties designated as extreme risk with Executive Order 2066, we expect to see continued decline in lottery revenues. And based on information provided by DAS and OSL, we envision $71 million lower in lottery revenues between November 15th and December 31 than was projected. We also note that video gaming represent approximately 70% of lottery revenue. So the continued closure of facilities that promote lottery gaming, video lottery gaming, as we have seen, has a material impact on lottery revenues. And if that should persist in the future, through first, second quarter, we can expect to see additional reductions. Not only will this affect bonding capacity, but obviously it will affect programs that are funded through lottery revenues. Next slide. COVID-19 response and measures implemented to mitigate the spread of the virus are some of the risk factors that we face even into the first and second quarter of the calendar year and the remainder of our fiscal year 2021. In addition, some of the mitigating factors might be the additional federal stimulus funds, the effectiveness of the vaccines, and the use of the vaccine, whether or not there's any permanent damage to the economy arising from the failure of small businesses or change in behavioral patterns, like consumer utilization of facilities or gaming patterns exhibited by consumers. So these things will have their various effects. We obviously cannot predict, and we'll have to wait for the March report to see what some of these long-term implications are. Next slide. Okay, so I'll turn this over now to Matthew Harris, our debt manager, to cover the state of Oregon debt profile.
Thank you, Jacqueline. I'm getting a bit of an echo. If everybody could be on mute, I think that might help if I'm coming through on somebody's screen. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. Matthew Harris, debt manager for the Oregon State Treasurer's Office. I'm just going to give you an overview of our current debt profile. So I'll start with just a recap of the four types of long-term debt discussed in the report. First, we'll start with general obligation bonds. These are the bonds that require the full voter-approved constitutional amendment to be used because they pledge the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon. This will include both the general fund and non-general fund supported debt, so those paid for through general fund dollars versus those paid for via veterans welfare mortgage repayments, university revenues, etc. Second category is direct revenue bonds. These are generally created by statute. They are not secured by the full faith and credit of the state, but instead by the revenues of the programs themselves. This is like your lottery bonds, your highway user tax revenue bonds with ODOT. Third, we have the appropriation credits. Appropriation credits have been they've been decreasing over time as we've been shifting away from those into the general fund Article 11Q bond authorization because of benefits to cost, et cetera, that we'll discuss a little bit later. And then finally, conduit revenue bonds. These are the bonds that the state does issue, but we have no obligation to pay the debt service. They're passed through. They're paid by the entities on behalf of which we issue this debt. Turning to the next slide. Just to talk about four capacity categories in the report. First, there's the general fund supported debt. Just want to mention that historically, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission has recommended a target of at or below 5% of general fund revenues. There is also the lottery backed debt. We have legal bond covenants that limit capacity to 4x coverage, no more than 25% of net lottery revenues to be spent on debt service. That we have net tax supported debt. This is a category that's really the national bond rating, Moody's, S&P, et cetera, that they wanted to come up with a category of debt to be able to compare state to state. So for example, other states issue general obligation bonds for transportation, whereas we issue revenue bonds. So we're combining these things together. And then non-tax supported debt, there's no generic capacity limit. Each program within this is really managed to the revenue streams that are available. Turning to the next slide. just give you some trends recently in the state's bond indebtedness. At the end of fiscal year 20, the state had about $11.2 billion in debt outstanding. As you can see from the chart, debt levels have been pretty stable the last decade, as new issuance has been nearly on the same pace as the retirement of old debt. Appropriation bonds have declined, as I previously mentioned, because the projects that we typically fund with appropriation or had funded through appropriation credits are now funded through the Article 11Q bonds. And then you also see direct revenue, which, as I mentioned, includes ODOT, but it also includes Oregon Housing's single family mortgage program, lottery is mentioned, and the Business Oregon's bond bank program. So turning to the next slide, we'll talk about general obligation bonds in particular. And as of the end of fiscal year 20, you can see that nearly $6.5 billion in outstanding GO bonds there, nearly $4 billion of which are general fund supported. A little over $2.5 billion are supported by dedicated funds, again, such as veterans mortgages, university revenues, and a portion of the pension obligation bonds. And then to keep reiterating, 11Q has grown as we retire appropriation bonds by refinancing those into lower cost 11Q bonds. So turning to appropriation bonds specifically, the state has refunded about $1.1 billion of certificates of participation appropriation bonds with the lower cost 11Q bonds. Appropriation bonds have also declined as the bonds used to finance the fiscal year 2004 budget deficit were fully paid off in 2013. So turning to revenue bonds, as of the end of fiscal year 20, about $4.6 billion in direct revenue bonds remained outstanding, the largest of which is Oregon Department of Transportation's Highway User Tax Bond Program, which was about $2.25 billion. These bonds are supported mainly by the gas tax revenues, DMV fees, and weight mile tax revenues. Lottery bonds themselves totaled about $1.1 billion. These bonds supported, of course, by unobligated lottery revenues. Single family mortgages were another $1.25 billion. They've increased due to the renewed need and demand for affordable housing. And then there's a smaller amount, $42.2 million outstanding for the Business Oregon's Bond Bank Program, and those are used to finance water and wastewater project loans to local governments. So turning to the next slide, just giving you a summary of all the non-tax supported debt programs, many of which we've already discussed. The one that we haven't really talked about that's on this list, we'll turn to the next slide with the School Bond Guarantee Program. So as many of you know, the state guarantees many local school district general obligation revenue bond or general obligation bonds, sorry. That allow school districts to attain a lower cost of funds than they could on their own. So that guaranteed debt service plus school pension debt, which also is pledged with the state aid that the state provides to local school districts, it's about 25% of annual, the combination of annual debt service on between the school bond guarantee and the pension bonds. So I'll just note that there are four districts that have annual debt service that exceed their state aid payments or projected state aid payments, and three of these are in the coastal communities that are subject to ongoing environmental risks. And then turning to my last page on conduit revenue bonds. So conduit revenue bonds, these are the ones that are issued by the state, as I mentioned, on behalf of obligated parties such as nonprofits or developers, you know, housing, industrial development, et cetera. But these bonds, the state is not legally obligated to pay. They are pass-through. And the state has four main pass-through programs. The first being the Oregon Facilities Authority. We are able to get allow some bonds to be issued with 501c3 nonprofits for different projects, industrial development revenue bonds for economic development, housing development revenue bonds for low-income multifamily apartment complexes, this category of which has increased considerably in the last few years as the state invests more in local housing programs. And then the last one is the beginning and expanding farmer loan revenue bond program, which hasn't been utilized much to date. And so with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Lee Helgerson, our senior debt manager.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Matthew Says. This is Lee Helgerson with the Debt Management Division. As shown on this slide, next page, please. There you go. As shown on this slide, the state maintains very high credit ratings from Moody's, S&P, and Fitch. The ratings include a AA1, AA plus for the general obligation program, as well as AAA rated lottery revenue bonds and ODOT's highway user tax revenue bonds. The four basic analytical areas considered by the rating agencies in their credit analysis include the economy, financial performance and flexibility, debt burden, and administration. For the general obligation bond program, the analysis also considers total net tax-supported debt, as well as pension and other post-employment benefits. Next page. Okay. So as shown on this page, net tax supported debt includes all general fund supported debt programs, but also the dedicated fund portion of the pension obligation bonds, as well as the Article 11Q general obligation bonds. In addition, the certificates of participation, lottery revenue bonds, and also ODOT's highway user tax revenue bond program. Next page. As of the end of the fiscal year 2020, Oregon's net tax-supported debt was approximately $8.4 billion. This is projected to increase to approximately $9.3 billion by the end of the current fiscal year 2021. Oregon's net tax-supported debt to personal income at 3.9% is a bit above the national median of 2.6%. However, when you exclude the pension obligation bonds issued in 2003, this reduces Oregon's net tax-supported debt to approximately 3.4% of personal income. Next page. On this chart, it shows the state's net tax-supported debt per capita over the last decade has been relatively consistent. In 2020, at $1,900 per capita, it is just a bit higher than the national median of $1,071. Next page. And in addition to net tax-supported debt, the rating agencies are concerned with the overall balance sheet liability, which includes net unfunded pension and other post-employment benefit liabilities. As the table shows, Oregon's overall liability ratios have been relatively consistent and generally at affordable levels. And next page. Regarding pension and other post-employment benefits, the state pension funding levels as represented in this chart shows Oregon to be in a comparatively enviable position relative to many other states, with its pension and OPEB funding levels well above 80% or above 80%. Next page. And again, the chart on this page shows that the funding of Oregon's pension and other post-employment benefits is among the highest nationally. Methodologies used by the credit rating agencies scores the state's combined debt and pension profiles quite favorably, with Moody's assigning it a score of AAA and S&P noting in its May 29, 2020 report that Oregon's share of the net pension liability is considered to be relatively low and manageable, especially when compared to other states. Some of Oregon's credit strengths include strong liquidity and rainy day fund balances that support budget flexibility, sound financial controls underscored by sophisticated quarterly revenue forecasting, and executive authority to reduce spending. Other fundamentals include strong in-migration and average job growth, and also below fixed average costs relative to the well-funded retirement system that offsets somewhat our above-average bonded debt ratios. Some of the challenges regarding credit ratings includes the unusually high reliance on the economically sensitive personal income tax, as well as governance constraints, including the constitutional 2% kicker, the initiative process, and a supermajority requirement to increase taxes. Growth in pension liabilities and contributions will also increase budgetary pressure in the future, most likely, although it's still expected to remain below the median national average. So, and that concludes this section. I believe Jacqueline?
Thank you, Mr. Helgerson. Jacqueline.
Yes, thank you very much, Lee. Those were excellent points about the credit ratings perspective, especially the well management of the pension plan and pension funding strategy of the state and how it contributes to the strong ratings. Laura Wirth is going to assist. She and I will tag team this next section, general fund debt capacity analysis. Laura?
Yes, in this section, we're turning to debt supported by general fund revenues. And as you're likely aware, general obligation bonds are for public schools, a small amount for state highway, higher ed, seismic rehabilitation, and pension obligation, pollution control, and alternate energy supported by general fund revenues. And as Matthew has recently explained, the Oregon has reduced the use of certificate of participation due to the greater cost of capital associated with them in recent years. Our model inputs and assumptions for general fund debt capacity have not changed, and our analysis assumes $1.14 billion in planned issuance by the end of the biennium. It accounts for all $3.9 billion in general fund supported debt outstanding as the end of fiscal year 20. It uses the OEA's December 2020 revenue forecast and structures new debt with level debt service over 20 years at 4.5% interest rate. Lastly, it assumes that the target debt service to revenue cap put in place by the commission. Jacqueline?
I do not want to scare anyone with this chart. It is actually a very good chart. We have this dark blue line on the bottom represents the principal of existing State of Oregon general fund debt. The lighter blue line is the interest on that debt. And the green line represents, the green bars represent the debt service for the bonds that we're issuing in the 2019-21 biennium. That's the extent of the authorized debt, and we expect to fully issue that. One of the great things about this, and it plays into the rating agency strategy, is that the debt has a short average life and amortizes quickly. We have this red dotted line at the top left, and that line represents the revenues that are available at the 5% target limit for debt service. So when we maximize our debt issuance capacity over the forecast period, which is FY 2022 to FY 2029, we will basically increase our debt service to the level of that line. As Lee mentioned in his presentation, one of the offsetting factors to Oregon's growing debt is the growing population, which is significant and has been for many, many decades. So while we expect that line to go up with the capacity, we're encouraged that we will have continued growth in population and personal income associated with it. Next slide. This slide looks at the model output for the debt capacity analysis for general fund. And we have several columns in this report. The second column from the left shows the maximum capacity that could be issued in each year based on the December 2020 forecast for general fund revenues. And in the aggregate, that is $6.255 billion. And as you can see with the next column, that gives us 5% debt service, that is 5% of the general fund revenues. In general, we've recommended to the state a more measured approach to issuing debt rather than the jagged approach in this debt capacity analysis in column two. So we generally recommend averaging the capacity over the 8-year period. And with that in mind, we come up with a debt capacity or recommended maximum annual issuance amount of $781.9 million, or $1.56 billion in each biennium over the forecast period. And one thing we should note, Laura, if you could just go back, with the averaging approach, there will be some years where we will be slightly above the 5% target, but eventually we get back to that. So as an example, in 2022 and 23, using our typical maximum capacity in column 2, we would have only issued in the 2022-23 about $1 billion. Whereas using the averaging approach, we've moved up some of that capacity to the early years, so we would have a slightly higher target. But as you can see, we're not using up the $2 billion that's available after 2028. That's when the pension bonds amortize. So this gives us a more measured approach. It also preserves the flexibility and the capacity in the future. Next slide. In addition to measuring capacity, our analysis runs some sensitivity analysis. Sensitivity of issuance capacity to changes in general fund revenue forecast and changes in capacity due to changes in interest rate assumptions. In terms of general fund forecast changes, we look at a 10% decline or a 10% increase in general fund revenues. And should we have a 10% decline in general fund revenues, we would expect to see a decline of $924 million in capacity over the forecast period. And again, that is FY 2022 to FY 2029. And that would reduce the capacity from $6.22 billion to $5.33 billion. An increase in general fund revenues has the effect of increasing our capacity to by $1.17 billion to $7.4 billion. Interest rate changes, we assume a 4.5% interest rate, and we base that off the 10-year average of a bond buyer geo index that is comprised of general obligation bonds, 20-year life, 20-year final maturity with average ratings in the AA3 category, which is already a conservative estimate. The bond buyer index as of the date of this report, as of December 15, was about 3.76. So we're not hugely far off from it. But should rates rise by 1%, we would expect to see a lower issuance capacity, a reduction of $467 million. And should rates go lower, we would have enhanced capacity of $795 million to $7.05 billion. So in sum, as far as the general fund is concerned, next slide, our forecast indicates that we're able to complete the issuance of the $1.14 billion as authorized in the 2019 and 20 legislatures. Thus far, we've issued $199 million and we are on target to issuing the remaining $940 million of authorized bonds. Further, we estimate that the state can issue the $1.56 billion or recommend that the state issue $1.56 billion over the next four biennium for an aggregate of $6.255 billion. Next slide.
Now we turn our attention to lottery debt funds. Are you hearing a echo?
Slight one, but it seems to have gone away now, maybe.
Okay, great. Lottery debt funds, a multitude of projects that create jobs, further economic development, support public education, and protect Oregon's parks, beaches, watersheds, and critical fish and wildlife habitats. The graph on this slide provides a visual showing how the lottery revenue forecast has varied over the last several years. Even before COVID, there have been periods of uncertainty in lottery revenue forecasts, such as earlier uncertainty about the impact of introducing casino and gaming in Washington state. This brings home the point that due to the COVID pandemic, we are currently presenting a forecast with underlying uncertainty due to the closure of establishments that support video gaming. Facilities remain closed and other economic factors such as sustained employment affect gaming. The December 2020 forecast projects that lottery revenue will be $1.28 billion in this biennium and is expected to rise to $1.9 billion in the 2027-29 biennium. In terms of model inputs and assumptions, nothing has changed. And this forecast accounts for about $1.1 billion lottery revenue bonds issued and outstanding as of the end of the fiscal year, uses OEA's December 2020 forecast of lottery revenue, and the bonds structured with level debt service over 20-year term using a 4.5% interest rate. Jacqueline, you're on mute.
Thank you, Laura. This page seeks to mimic what we did for the general fund capacity, which we measure capacity each year by the available revenues, except that lottery revenues are constrained by a 4x coverage, meaning that unobligated net lottery proceeds need to be 4x the amount of debt service that's associated with the lottery revenue bonds. On the flip side, lottery debt service on lottery revenue bonds cannot exceed 25% of net unobligated lottery proceeds. And so based on that constraint, we estimate that using the December 2020 forecast that there's $1.628 billion in lottery capacity. Generally, if we just looked at the straight capacity issuance, it fluctuates from year to year. So again, we propose a more streamlined and smoother approach by averaging the issuance, the $1.628 billion, over the forecast period, which results in $203.5 million per year, or $407 million for each biennium. Next slide. Again, parallel to what we've done with general fund, we measure the sensitivity of lottery revenues to changes in the actual lottery revenue projections and also to interest rates. Once again, the initial issuance is $1.62 billion, that's our capacity. With a 10% decline in lottery revenues, we expect to see $314 million decline in capacity. Now, this decline is over the entire forecast period, not just a single year. And I just want to clarify that. If we had a 10% increase in lottery revenues over the forecast period, we could expect to see an increase in the capacity by $369 million, or a total capacity of $1.997 billion. With interest rate changes, a 1% increase in interest rates would reduce capacity by about $158 million to $1.47. And should rates go lower than what we've assumed, we would increase capacity by $237 million to $1.865 billion. Next slide. Now here's the rub. While the December 2020 forecast projects $1.628 billion in capacity, since the release of the forecast, lottery revenue has declined materially, as we have discussed earlier. Again, as of December 18, OSL estimates that these reductions or measures to curb and curtail the spread of the COVID-19 has resulted in $71 million reduction in lottery revenue from November 15th to December 31. Given the continuing situation presented by COVID-19, it is anticipated that there will be continued reduction in lottery revenues due to continued closures. One of the estimates that came to the forefront in our disclosures recently was that should all 20 counties that are categorized right now as extreme risk remain in that category, we can expect to see a reduction in lottery revenues on a monthly basis of the tune of $45 million. So these are numbers here on this page. We can't predict the future, but clearly, this is a material deterioration, and there's significant volatility and uncertainty in the future of lottery revenue forecasts. Next slide. In reviewing all of the state's debt, one of the things that we hope we would bring value to are areas of concerns for the commission, for the commissioners. In one particular area, while this is not bonds per se, but we, the federal government allocates what we call private activity bond volume cap to states annually. And this stays distributed to various entities that don't quite qualify for general purpose governmental tax exempt issues, but can benefit from the private activity tax exemption, which is generally subject to something called alternative minimum tax. Historically, the legislature, the Oregon legislature, and the PAB committee have allocated Oregon's private activity bond volume cap. Legislatively, since the last fiscal year, roughly $292 million of this capacity has been allocated at the legislative level, leaving the private activity bond committee to allocate the remainder. So in 2020, the PAB committee had volume cap of $150.4 million to allocate. Of the $442 million of PAP capacity that we had in 2020, Oregon utilized $56.8 million. But also, we have to recognize another use of PAP capacity. During 2020, an additional $270 million in previous year allocations, i.e. allocations that were made in 2017-19 and are now carried forward, were entirely used by Oregon Housing to support single-family, first-time homebuyer, and tax-exempt multifamily affordable housing projects around the state. And this is an extremely important and growing area. In general, housing does not use its current year capacity immediately because the projects take time to come to fruition. So that's why the carry forward is very important. And when the housing uses the carry forward, it is an excellent use of it because the carry forward will expire if left unused and will go back to the federal government. The 2020 carry forward of private activity volume cap is $386 million. To date, Oregon Housing has requested $370 million. It's anticipated that they have needs for the full $386 million. In 2021, as I noted earlier, the volume cap will go up to $466 million. The legislature is expected to allocate $292 million of that, which will leave the PAB committee with $174 million to allocate. It is a policy of the PAB committee to split its allocation authority into four quarters. So effectively, we will have $43 million available in our January meeting to allocate. To date, we have one request that correlates very nicely with this authority that we can allocate, which is from the Home Forward program, an affordable housing program. We have no other projects at this time that is seeking funding for our upcoming meeting next week. In addition, in speaking to housing, they have a strong pipeline, and there is growing pipeline. It's not just a state agency. There are many groups across the state that need the private activity bond allocation. So we note that Metro voters voted for approximately $653 million of geo bond issue for this purpose. The city of Portland also has increased need for affordable housing that will use the volume cap. And many of the affordable housing projects are supported by 4% low-income housing tax credits. And volume cap supports your ability to meet this match, the 50% match, if they take advantage of the 4% tax credit. So that's one growing area. And we had a conversation earlier with housing, which had them with a strong pipeline for utilization of the capacity. And with the current situation with COVID, we expect to see additional needs for affordable housing and programs that will compete with other economic development projects that may be seeking volume cap in the future. Other emerging areas of concern, these have been on the plate for quite some time. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission study on facilities and replacement of facilities. We note that they have designated 2.5% per year for current placement value, which would translate into about $250 million per year. There are other programs of the state that's looking to enhance facilities to make them more resilient for the future, as we all know, with our nice new building coming up. In addition to those items, I want to spend some time on the COVID-19 response and wildfire cleanup. Recently, in December, the legislature convened its 2020 third special session. And the outcome of that session was SB 5731, which codified $800 million of FY 2021 general fund appropriations directed to addressing challenges presented by wildfire and COVID-19. As you can see, they're outlined here. Of note, there's $400 million for COVID-19, $100 million for wildfire, $150 to $200 million for housing through either landlord assistance or tenant rental assistance. What's important, if you could turn to the next slide, we want to just reiterate that COVID-19 will have economic, educational, social, and human costs that will have long enduring effects and will require significant investments in many areas. These are economic development, rebuilding of cities and towns, job readiness and training for displaced people through sustained unemployment, and closure of facilities, affordable housing, and housing for the homeless. Wildfire presents another challenge, because it consumes so much of the state's landmass. Although we're working on the more recent wildfires, and there is monies allocated in the legislative session, but we want to note that FEMA funds are made on a reimbursement basis. And therefore, the state will have to expend its resources not only for the state's cost share, but also for the FEMA component, subject to the time that the monies are received from FEMA. So there need to be mechanisms in place to address interim funding of the wildfire. In conclusion, forecasted general revenue we discussed provides $6.3 billion of new general fund debt capacity with an average debt capacity of 1.56 per biennium. And we are pleased to say that the $1.139 billion in FY 2021 will be on track. Forecasted lottery revenues will provide $1.628 billion of capacity or an average of $407 million. Lottery revenues continue to demonstrate significant volatility, and we expect that volatility to continue. As a result of the volatility, we expect that there will be no issuance of lottery revenue bonds in FY 2021, and therefore for the 2019-21 biennium, we will see a situation where there's no lottery revenue bonds issued. The state has maintained strong credit ratings due to its adherence to prudent debt management practices as discussed. While general fund revenues were modestly lower, we pride ourselves on its resilience. Again, we reiterate that we believe the effects of COVID-19 will require significant investment of state resources after federal stimulus monies are no longer available. To improve the state's resilience, this investment is required to shore up state facilities, wildfire preparedness, and prevention and restoration of communities. The Commission recommends continued prudence in the management of debt and its use, and the making of capital investments in infrastructure, housing, economic development, higher education, and other projects that will have long-term effects and build the state's resilience. This concludes the Debt Management Division's report to the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Harris, for helping us get through that in a pretty fast fashion. I note that we're 5 minutes till five. I can stay a bit late. I certainly don't want to cut the conversation short. But having said that, I think it's fair to say, Jacqueline, and I'm just going to look at your face on my screen to see if you're nodding or shaking your head no, that in general, what you've told us is there's some slight changes from the last time we talked, but not massive changes. And if I'm right about that, hopefully our task in communicating that to the legislature is a bit less onerous than if there were wild changes. Having said that, and appreciate your general nod, Representative Nathanson let me know she had a few comments, so I want to go to her first. Representative Nathanson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. I had read most of the report before we had the presentation. Thank you very much for providing it in advance. It was a very good, thorough presentation. Here are my comments on the written report, because this is an annual report and some people do read it or find that they refer to it later, go back to it for some reason. My first comment is, on page one of the report, because this is a very unusual time and this report is different than almost any other report this commission would have ever given, I'd appreciate it if others agree with me, for me, I'd like to mention that as well as the purposes you talk about, public, it starts out, public borrowing is an important tool in Oregon's efforts to improve the state's infrastructure, educational capacity, and public buildings, et cetera. And it goes on to say later, we have to remember that we have to be very judicious in our use of debt. I would really like to make a comment in this one annual statement, at least, that debt, if used wisely, can be it can be used wisely as an economic stimulus to support individuals, families, and businesses to prevent further deterioration of the economy and tax-based revenues. We don't talk about debt as a stimulus, but because it, if it's the right kind of debt, not just to support ongoing operations, but if it's supporting the short-term jobs and then the ancillary industry sectors that support the construction, and then you have the asset for a long period afterwards, I just think I would like to include that if others agree. And I can be shorter with my other comments. On page 3,
Just going to interrupt for a second and acknowledge, yeah. I see you raising your hand, Senator Johnson. I'll come to you. And I'm assuming that means sort of an endorsement of Representative Nathanson's comment. No, it's not. We'll come to you afterwards and we can hear from you. Thank you.
On page 7 of the report, net tax supported debt, it says that we have used all of these kinds of debt to address deferred maintenance and critical building and infrastructure needs. I just want to acknowledge, at least verbally, there are times when we use this debt to support other types of projects for community benefit. It wouldn't necessarily fit in the critical building or infrastructure needs, but it was some sort of community benefit. I just feel like, for me to be intellectually honest, I have to say it out loud. I know sometimes we use debt for that. On page 9, where we talk about wildfires and economic loss, it does refer to the estimates don't account for economic losses. But I wonder if we want to say something about it, in addition to helping what we normally fund, there's going to be a lot of pressure to help communities replace housing or replace other types of community resources. I just don't know if we want to mention that in the it's because of the wildfires. We've got to do more than just pay our share of the costs. Talks about FEMA and so forth. But I think the wildfires caused additional demands for infrastructure help. And then my final comment is on page 10, funding of deferred maintenance for state facilities. We have learned now that a lot of people are going to be interested in working from home, either all the time or at least part-time. I've talked about looking at what we need for classrooms. Well, we need to think about what we're going to need for offices, too. We don't know really whether we have the right mix now permanently. You know, there's probably a permanent shift now in how we work. And so a lot of what we fund is buildings, but those buildings primarily, it's not just sheds to hold the lawnmowers, that are in use. And it's not facilities to hold things. Most of our square footage is to house people, either in the offices or classrooms at colleges and universities. So I think we're probably going to want to be very cautious in the future about approving not only additional office space, but but maybe even what we think we need to do deferred maintenance on, because maybe we don't actually need to maintain that building. Maybe we need to think about backing out of it now because we don't need it anymore.
Thank you, Representative. I think your notes of caution are smart. Before I recognize Senator Johnson, Laura, would you mind taking down the screen share? We can put it back up if we need it, but it'll just be easier for me to see the other people and maybe better interpret Senator Johnson's head shaking. Sorry, I got that wrong the first time. Senator Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. In the main, I agree with Representative Nathanson, but I have a couple of thoughts. One of them is about the suggestion that bonding is an economic stimulus. I agree with. However, I'm worried that a comment like that included in the report might give rise to the pressure by our legislative colleagues to want to go out and bond a lot. As early as this morning, I heard someone in leadership say, bonding is looking good. We may have way more capacity than we thought. And I just don't want to incentivize a lot of bonding pressure. I'm taking a very conservative view, judging by the number of businesses that are failing in my district right now, and my concern systemically long-term about our economic architecture. The next thing is that I completely agree with Representative Nathanson's comments about our square footage needs. And I had a very robust conversation with Ms. Koba the other day. She's on this call, so she will remember it, wherein I asked whether or not we were evaluating our square footage needs before we pushed ahead with the building of the Department of Human Services Taj Mahals in Klamath Falls and Gresham, which I add incidentally, both had their contract parameters changed without reissuing a solicitation, doubled the square footage of one of them roughly. So my concern is to try to keep us on a very conservative path and not use economic stimulus as a code for let's just bond like crazy. Last but not least, in looking at the report that we followed today, which was excellent, by the way, and I appreciated the presenters, I drew my attention to Red Rock's biofuel, which has sucked up an awful lot of bonding capacity. And I don't know how that project is performing, particularly sucked up is a technical term, Mr. Treasurer.
Understood.
And I don't know how that project is performing. I could throw a rock from my office and hit a failed bonding project a few miles down the river that has been a source of continuous headache. And I don't know how acutely we're monitoring Red Rock's performance metrics.
I will defer the specific answer on Red Rock to Ms. Nice, but with your permission, I might suggest we take that sort of separately from the report, if that's okay.
I'm fine with that.
Perfect. Thank you.
It's appropriate, actually.
And by the way, anytime you need me to back you up in urging some caution with legislators, anyone who's saying bonding is looking good, feel free to call me and I can jump on the phone with you or anything else.
Well, one of the problems that we're going to have is that the whole last lottery bond list was deferred when we couldn't meet the coverage ratio.
Right.
There is enormous pressure on all of those projects to get back in the queue. I will tell you that some of them are stinkers. There was another technical term. Mm-hmm. There was very little analysis or engineering done prior to adding them to the list. And I think that list ought to be scrubbed. And while that list sits in stasis, we've got a whole nother queue forming up behind it.
Right.
And so the pressure on lottery bonds is going to be substantial, and I don't want to mix bond types, but I'm just saying there is mounting enthusiasm across all bond issuances to go out and just bond like crazy.
Right. Well, this group is uniquely situated to help push against that. Let's continue around the horn. I won't call on anyone in particular, but if there are any other of our commissioners who would like to weigh in, we'd be eager to hear from you.
So I'll just Please. Add that you're correct, is that you could, in theory, use the bonding capacity for stimulus, but you know, I think Senator Johnson's right. If we open that door, we kind of have to open it all the way and say, okay, let's raise the target to 6% or something. And I don't know that this commission is prepared to do that. Otherwise, we're kind of giving them, you know, a reason to go ahead and do that, regardless of whether we sign off on that or not. And so, you know, we would want to be cautious in that. And, you know, again, I think we've had the conversation in this group before that many of our capital needs probably should be reevaluated anyway in light of the COVID pandemic. And so, you know, the extent that we keep pushing that story, I think is helpful.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Koba?
I agree with what's been said and don't have anything to add.
Okay. Thank you. So the only thing that we need to do then, and then we can come back to the update on Red Rocks, is get a consensus sort of about our next approach. And I can be overruled, of course, but I would suggest that given the relatively modest changes in one instance from where we have been to where we are, and given the good comments from Representative Nathanson and Senator Johnson and Dr. Dewey, and yours as well, Ms. Koba, that we can incorporate those and transmit the report without needing to impose on your time for a follow-up meeting, as we have sometimes done since we've gone through that before. Senator Johnson, you're on mute before you start talking. You're still on mute.
I'm sorry. One last comment that I would make is, and this is the same comment that I made the last time, we don't mention pending litigation and or potential settlements. And I think that those are material facts that need to be called out. Judging by the track record of some of the folks that we have hired to do the debris and hazard tree removal, there is a long and notorious trail of litigation. We still have $1 billion judgment against us, $1 billion and some, that's costing $260,000 a day not to settle. An extension was given on some filings, a 28-day extension, and if my math is correct, it cost the state $7 million in interest. And I think that those are material facts that need to get acknowledged somewhere in the report. Now, I have to plead guilty, unlike Representative Nathanson, who read the whole underlying report. I didn't make it all the way through. And Ms. Knight, I apologize if there is mention of that, but I think that we need to acknowledge those issues.
I should say that, if I would, Treasurer Reed, just a couple comments on this. In terms of fiscal stimulus and the use of debt, I would like to note that investment in infrastructure, highways, bridges, tolls, business development districts, these are all stimulus activities. And so to the extent that we can codify or name the type of stimulus, that would be extremely valuable, and it would not be interpreted as a slush fund or a mandate to just go out and issue a lot of debt. So I would just caution that we would just want to delineate exactly what those projects may look like.
That's really where I'm trying to drive, because I have confidence, Ms. Knights, in you and your team to do that expertly in the course of the narrative. So I think we can do that. Representative Nathanson, I saw your hand up, please.
Yeah, thank you. There is at least one place in the report, but maybe only one, where I saw that you had included something like technology upgrades as part of infrastructure. It's not mentioned in at least one other place where you talk about infrastructure, but anymore, extending broadband to serve whether it's state office buildings or hospitals or schools or whatever, it ends up then being a touch point. You can go out from there to serve the local community, whether it's small businesses or even homes. So broadband investment, but also all the IT stuff. When you have failing computer systems, and we have all sorts of cyber attack vulnerability, we've got to make those investments as well.
You're getting enthusiastic nods.
I agree completely.
And just one other item, Senator Johnson, you were very kind, but we have not included any discussion on judgments in this particular report. This report seems to cover the debt issuance capacity. We do, in our official statements when we issue bonds, cover judgments against the state because that's a material risk that bondholders need to be aware of. So we have an entire section in each of the official statement that we provide to the investor community of judgments, and we do get DOJ involved in that. So that's where we currently represent litigation. But I do, you know, understand your point significantly. Litigation has been something, and judgments has been something that many, many states have issues with, and they have not properly addressed it as part of a debt management strategy. Like we've addressed pensions as a potential liability and have wrestled with it. Now it's time to look at these judgments, and I've seen other jurisdictions do the same, but just wanted to clarify that point that it's not in this report, but it is in the official statements that we present to the bond rating agencies and to investors.
Thank you. Perhaps I'm channeling my enthusiasm to explore the notion of using debt to settle that case. I know that there is a school of thought that believes if it goes to the Court of Appeals that the state will prevail. There is also a school of thought that says they lose. And if there was a way to settle that, bonding the judgment, and I'm a little out of my depth here. I'm looking at the professor who's scowling at me.
I can't remember what the judgment, what the size of the judgment was. And I was thinking
it's a billion. It's $1.065 billion. It's so the Linn County lawsuit.
Right. It'd wipe out what, a year and a half, 2 years of capacity, year and a half of capacity.
Well, I'm hoping for some kind of a settlement that cuts down that judgment and gets it off the books. And I mean, that's a not insignificant at 9% interest. I'm just channeling Ms. Knight, my enthusiasm, to perhaps explore settlement and bonding as a source of repayment.
Okay.
I mean, that's a very large political issue. As I explained to Trevor Reed, I am low on the politics scale because many constituents do not believe that bond funds should be used to pay for things like operating cost and things of that nature. So I can definitely see a major fight relating to this. That is a battle to be fought. And
trust me, I see the same dark clouds on the horizon.
Okay. Well, thank you.
And you said it very nicely, both of you. So let me see if I can sum up then. It sounds like there is a little bit of a consensus emerging here in terms of, with the comments that you've all made, handing them back to Ms. Knights and her team to incorporate and integrate and not needing to gather everyone again. Is anyone objecting to that plan? No one's objecting, I don't think. Okay, good. Okay, so that frees us up, I think, considerably. I want to note that it's 5:15 and we can keep talking. Definitely can give you an update on Red Rocks again. But given that you've already hung in there 15 minutes past our target time, we can also adjourn officially and say goodbye and reconvene with you, Senator Johnson, and give you the rest of the update if you'd like.
That's fine. I think it's more appropriate to discuss Red Rocks out of this kind of a setting. I just was flagging the question of performance, and that's all.
I think you and I have a separate meeting scheduled in the next several days or maybe week, and so we could do it then too.
Treasurer Reed, could I get at least the Cliff Notes version that Senator Johnson gets on Red Rocks?
Of course. I think we have a meeting with you too, so we'll do the same thing. You bet.
Okay.
No problem. Is there anything else we need to cover this afternoon? Okay. Well, thank you again, as always. Your wisdom, expertise, perspective is very helpful, and we'll do it again, hopefully not next week. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year to you all.
Same to you.